The stone was found by a Canadian mining company and was uncovered using X-ray technology.
Botswana comes from a traditionally diamond mining, and as we've been mining for over 50 years now, we saw that it is indeed pertinent that we advance beyond just diamond mining into other mineral sectors.
Botswana has got the unenviable position of GDP contractions, while at the same time having to increase its debt load to try and service government's imperatives for the upliftment of the country.
Rankings by the World Bank and the UN Development Reports indicate that for sub-Saharan Africa, Botswana has the highest GDP per capita, sitting at 69.79% for life expectancy and third in Africa for Human Development Index. By 2021, Botswana enjoyed the highest growth average in economic growth rate at 4.91%. A question formed in my mind: how did Botswana spectacularly achieve what many of her African counterparts, through a series of government changes, have not been able to benchmark or surpass? Admittedly, not without challenges, Botswana is still a rich example of when good governance meets a human-centered approach to growth and development, not only for the country, but for her people. Furthermore, what is Botswana's perspective on how this sustained success has affected their well-being and upliftment, particularly observing the balance between people's rights and the pursuit of profit? Hello and welcome back to the final episode of Season 6 of the Let's Talk Human Rights podcast. I am your host, Masechaba Masemola Wamdag. Now, Botswana is the second largest diamond producer globally and maintains a high public investment profile, especially in human capital and infrastructure, supported by prudent fiscal policy, which essentially means the government is managing its money in a wise, careful, and responsible way. Botswana's geographic size against its population allows for exploration and extractions and more development in the mining sector. Factually and statistically, Africa's experience with dealing with extractive industries has been marred by instances of thriving kleptocratic systems of government and grand corruption. This has resulted in significant subversion of the political, legal, and economic systems of resource-dependent countries. Botswana was never the case. At the time of independence, Botswana branded herself as a model of racial harmony by curtailing all ethnic sentiments and speaking rather to the broader Botswana nation. But this has, over the decades, not fallen short of receiving criticism, where the government has delayed acknowledging indigenous groups, especially where removals of people have taken place to accommodate mining ventures. The country has also largely fostered a long history and culture of participatory democracy by still maintaining chieftaincies as a way to get community buy-in and consensus. This is also, as many may think, despite it being under the same political party, which is the BDP, since independence, Botswana has maintained political stability and more recently undergone peaceful transition of power in 2024. With diamond reserves no longer being the steady future of the country's economy, coal, copper, granite, and nickel are set to take over the well-established diamond industry. The need for diversification away from dependence on diamonds has fueled a desire to promote other mining activities in the country, as well as the need to prepare, upskill, and cross-skill the workforce for the envisaged changes, while also pushing for promotion of entrepreneurship. For citizens to continue to benefit from the country's natural resources, national leaders must remain on the trajectory that has been in place since independence and not be tempted by short-term gains. How did the Botswana government succeed in making diamond mining a profitable business beyond only being a diamond producer? How will they overcome the era of the diamond crisis? And what does the roadmap for the future look like? And so, our road trip to Botswana began to go listen and experience firsthand what all this means for this African nation. Letlhakane is a village in the central district of Botswana and the headquarters of the Bodedi sub-district. It is located south of Matshumo, 28 kilometers from Oraba, and the population was 22,911 in 2011 census. In the shade of an acacia tree on a hot day, I sit down with José Alfred Betelelo to hear what the chieftaincy has to say about the social economic development in the town and how it has evolved in recent years. This is interpreted by Mpati Cingo.
The way I see Letlhakane is a community that's fast growing. It has left some people behind, especially the unemployed. The way the community is growing is because of the mines. The people that are not from here would think there are plenty of job opportunities. There are a few mines around. Letlhakane mine, Karoo mine, Orapa mine, and Damsa mine. If a lot of people come into the community, the planned projects will be weighed down because of the increase of people and there will be fewer opportunities. The way it's growing, I see it becoming a bigger town than it is now.
The impact of economic migrants is a long-standing tale, not just in Botswana, but telling of developing and bustling emerging economies. Chief Betelelo goes on further to describe the other impacts which have had far-reaching implications on their town.
Today, there are people that don't have jobs. It's hard for people. Our land of Letlhakane is lacking rainy seasons. Our land is dry and we can't plant. Our land will be affected if the weather conditions don't change. Our kids go to school, but they're dropping out because of teenage pregnancy. The community is growing because of a lot of people coming into our community. They come alone, leave their spouses behind, and infidelity takes place, and that alone causes problems and chaos, especially if they infect each other with various sicknesses. Women also fall pregnant because of a ticket to a meal. The way things are going, other people are losing a lot. If people had jobs, they wouldn't focus on arrangements that don't benefit them. We have working relationships and are in communication with the mines, and there's meetings with the leaders. There are more developments at Karoo mine, and they search schools around to find students with a high pass rate to take on roles at the mine. The trust was initiated by the mine, and the starting fund was around 500,000 bula. Even after the fund, there's nothing happening, even after the land was found. And the fund was given by Debswana mine, after finding out that the living status isn't good. A total amount of 1.5 million pula was given to be divided by three amongst the poor communities. Even when there are changes in the growth of the mine, they communicate with us with all new developments.
I was very fortunate to interview Mr. Baloy, who was part of the first group of people to start working at the mine in Letlhakane in 1966. I asked him about what he remembers of that time and the changes that have happened since. This is once again interpreted by Mpati Cingo.
We were the first group to start working at the mines. Back then, things were okay. There was no disorder and discrimination. Even the people who couldn't write had secured jobs at the time. We knew and were certain that the mine will be there for a very long time. We were very happy, and our salaries then was very good, and we used to take home about 10,000 pula. The salary we got was great then, and we could do a lot with that amount. Unlike now, as times have changed, taking that amount isn't enough in today's living status. Working in the first mines was great. I really enjoyed my time there. Even our fellow brothers that you are familiar with worked there, and we worked after them. There was no degree, qualification papers, or interviews needed to get a job. All you had to present was your identification. There was no better living after the mine started operating. After technology took place, then we were fired, retrenched, and things got worse from there. And educated people took over. There were a lot of changes, and as new people came and also started to steal the diamonds. What messed things up as well is stealing of the diamonds. And then after messing up and stealing the diamonds, then you're required to have a qualification to have a job at the mines. And the cleverer and more qualified were rather needed. There was a union in place that stood up for the employees, and that helped us take care of issues, especially when we were underpaid. There were unions. Now they are calling it mining workers' union. But during that time, there were no unions. There hasn't been any changes since then and now. Before, they used to say that they will fix the issues that we had then, but nothing was solved. We were then given permanent permits. Even after having kids, I'm still struggling. The government promised to build me a family house that has electricity, but I'm still without all that till today. They still need to give us something for working back then. So even after having kids, there hasn't been any changes at all. There's no change. Life didn't change. The Tlhakane people came and I got promised a lot, but I am still waiting. We did get pension payouts, but it wasn't a lot of money. It didn't do much at all then.
We travel through the hot and dusty town, connected by a handful of degraded roads, to meet with another community member. Nono volunteers at the Botswana Kwidom Council and is a Women League representative. Her job is to go around and check on the well-being of the Bakwe community that resides in Letlhakane. I'm interested in hearing her perspective on the younger generation and the possible opportunities available to them. Nono gives us her take, interpreted by Petunia Renz.
In this ward, the unemployment rate is very high and most of the young people don't work. Many of them did not finish school and most of them have moved from where they lived because the mines took over the land and neglected the communities. These people end up finding any plot to start building and end up at places where there is no water supply. Being unemployed is stressful and many of them depend on alcohol as there is nothing better to do with their time. There are jobs, but they are not available for the Letlhakane area. The Basaras now have a spokesperson and when there are meetings with the stakeholders, they engage with us. We have workshops and we go home with some knowledge that we share with the community. These problems have been addressed. And we have meetings with the Basaras Council of Churches who help with alcohol abuse. We have workshops around the area. The People's Art perform plays about alcoholism. And the Kwidom Council address others in Sesara language for better understanding. I dream of opportunities from any direction, either the mine or the government. I wish for phase one that there could be recreational facilities. We need places where people can go and learn something, not nightclubs.
Nono describes the unsettling situation of the social ills that plague the community of Letlhakane. Thembani Mpapo from the People's Arts similarly draws on the same lived experience by residents and where the primary causes emanate from, and how they, as an organization, strive to mitigate them.
Letlhakane, having men in being the mines dominating large numbers, it means a lot of women do not go to work. So they depend on their husbands or they depend on their partners financially. So the issues of GBV, gender-based violence, is high. Women are abused at higher numbers, they're beaten, they're emotionally abused just because they are not working or they're depending on their partners. The issues of rape and defilement, because we have vulnerable societies around Letlhakane, which means men have money power. They go to those vulnerable families. They use young kids. They defile them. After that, they bribe them. And nothing's been done. The same people of those vulnerable families, they depend on alcohol or they consume alcohol every day. So they depend on those men to buy them alcohol. That's why even if you can go to bars right now, there are people there drinking. It's 24-hour service every day. People drink. There's no rest. When others come from the mines, others they are at the bars, others are in the shifts. So it's a daily thing. So there are those youth or there are those ladies who drink non-stop. So after being taken by this one, it's taken by this one. Hence, the spread of disease, different diseases, HIV, STIs. So normally our organization touches those issues. And the other concerning issue is the issue of students who are leaving school at younger age because of where they
stay. So school dropout rates?
Yeah, at high rates. Especially those we call the Basara tribe, they grow up in that shabins, where they cook traditional beer. So the kid are around standard 4 or 5. They just quit school and nothing's been done. If you can go to the malls, you see young students asking for money. They are not going to school. They are drinking alcohol. Their others have been married at early age. They take husbands, they stay with them, and nothing's been done. Issues of rape that are being reported today. Tomorrow, they have been the cases are dismissed because they are the same people who are offering accommodations to the victims. The perpetrators, they give they're the ones who provide. In fact, the ladies or the mothers end up dropping the cases because they depend on the same perpetrator who uses the kid. So that's a concerning issue around here.
Can you maybe elaborate on some successes that you've had in community in terms of the work that you're doing? Do you see some steps towards some change in terms of behavior and social re-engineering, as it were?
Honestly, I see a very big change. At first, when they were inviting us to the mines, I think they were having almost daily toolbox talks or morning meetings in which they were addressing their employees. Like every month they had an incident or accident at the mine. Since we went there, the accident were dropping monthly. Then it went to 6 months without any accidents. Then for now, just on the 4th September, we are celebrating 2,000 days without any accident at the mine, which means people can hear and see during performances. We have been conducting different activities. For example, we're doing some matches, doing group discussions one-on-one around schools, around the communities, addressing different issues. We have been to the clinics, we have been to churches, passing messages of gender-based violence. But nowadays, I think people, even if we are going, when we pass, you will hear them saying, these ones are for GBV, or these ones are for HIV, which means people can hear us. Some even meditate our plays when they see us or our characters. Some, that, like I was saying, it's an issue of being pushed. I'm talking about financially, because I have volunteers who are close to 20. Who just volunteer. Some are even volunteering. They've been taken at the Department of Health. They're even volunteering there. But since we performed or passing messages using different platforms, facilitations, we have seen a big change.
The chief agrees with Tembane.
Botswana Council of Churches. They bring education to the people of the community and gain knowledge of things that they are not aware of. They point out things that encourage them to not give up and to continue fighting and speaking their truth. There are leaders from organizations and minds are supporting them too. Council of Churches feel for us and they tell people about our concerns. Bishop Mobedi and the Council of Churches came together to address the issue of underweight or malnutrition kids with Mr. Gabriel Tswaneng, who was the bishop before Mr. Mobedi. Mr. Mobedi is continuing with it too.
After hearing more about the daily lives and struggles of community members in Letlhakane, I sit down with Mr. Panyatsi Saluto from Quidong Council to talk about his role as civil society in a community that is predominantly a mining town and how they hold mining companies accountable to community development. This is interpreted by Mpati Kengo.
Botswana Kwedom Council is an organization that stands for the rights of Bakwe Basarwa. So work of the Botswana Council focuses on advocacy on human rights. Since we spoke to the mining companies and telling them that they need to bring corporate social responsibility at those communities. Since we started our conversation with the mining companies, we saw a big difference and it showed that our ask of forced eviction compensation. There was another issue that we gave them to hire the Basarwa community or people and give them skills development, and they said it is also underway and promised that they will hire them and enroll them in technical schools and give them jobs. And some of the things we see them not taking care of is the elderly. Our parents are staying in dilapidated houses like it's in Sudan. The local communities need to benefit more and you need to take all this serious. We want to participate in all decision making. It shows that since I started working with Kwedom Council, we started engaging with mining companies. The mines call and ask for meetings and assistance to align Baswara matters and human rights issues. There are positives, and the new government speaks more on human rights issues and applying cultural rights.
Speaking to Gitso Phiri from the Botswana Mine Workers Union, he weighs in on the approach to CSI and CSR initiatives, which are intended and designed to alleviate and uplift various aspects in the communities they operate in.
They said that there is no CSI framework or policy framework around how companies are supposed to engage in community. That's why they just do as they please when they want. Yeah. Is that the case?
It's a difficult question, and the answer is equally difficult because of how the law is structured. So if you look at the law, and maybe let me start first by saying we do not have a CSI policy in Botswana. So Botswana operates without a CSI policy. Mm-hmm. So it may be possible for communities and just interested parties to believe that CSI or CSR is not guided by any framework. Mm-hmm. However, we do have a tax law. So the Tax Act says companies are confined to three programs of CSR or CSI. So that's one: education, sports, and culture. So you may find that most of the companies would confine their CSRs to those three thematic areas, for lack of a better word. So which would mean that whatever interventions at community level that these companies do would be confined to those three areas or components. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that those three components have a tax implication. Obviously, the tax deductibles and whatever tax break-offs that, you know, these companies would ordinarily get. Mm-hmm. So which would mean that any CSR intervention is only confined to those three things. So if the community needs anything outside of those, I think the companies would not be possible to provide those programs or interventions. Or if they do, then those interventions really would be discretionary. So I think that's where it is. But we've been advocating to say maybe we need to expand the Tax Act, maybe draw from those and then, you know, legislate or promulgate a separate law or policy that can speak to that. But obviously a policy that would detail what, you know, CSR interventions or what areas, if any, you know, our CSR framework would need to mirror or reflect. So at least that would provide most of the companies, including the communities as well, with a guideline on what areas to pursue, if at all, you know, they're looking to either monitor or looking to have some of these companies actually implement some of these CSR programs.
As I said, you know, we've been speaking to different people, and of course, there's varying opinions on the topic around CSI and CSR. Mm. So you're saying that it is continuous. It happens on an ongoing basis.
Yes, it is continuous. Okay. Companies like Debswana, for instance, which is a subsidiary of Anglo, Anglo-American subsidiary of DBS as well. They've been doing very well, relatively well. I think because of the governance structure of Debswana, for instance, because it's half owned by government and also half owned by DBS. Mm-hmm. So I think the obligations that governments would ordinarily have, you know, towards its people are somewhat implemented or fulfilled through some of these programs. And that's why I would say or argue that CSR, especially from the Debswana side, is something that happens on an ongoing basis because of those, because of the government influence, right? And the obligation that the state has to its people.
And what of free, prior, and informed consent, otherwise known as FPIC?
I would say that it's kind of similar, but not, because in this instance, once the government identifies land that they believe their land can be used for public interest, then the government acquires or compulsorily acquire that land. And then, you know, that land, once it's acquired, the people will be relocated. And then there's compensation, reasonable compensation that is given the community or the person that's been affected by the compulsory acquisition. In this instance, I don't know whether or not any compensation was given or awarded as a result of the relocation, because we don't know whether it was forced or not. But if it was forced, then it goes against, you know, what the current government stands for. you know, because the government, well, at least the new administration says it's a human rights centered administration or government. Mm-hmm. So if at all those rights to ancestral lands, you know, rights to, you know, self-determination and also that connection, you know, with land, because, you know, there's a spiritual and cultural connection with land and people, especially as, you know, black people and our land. So if those rights have been infringed or violated by government, then obviously that's a matter that, you know, the people of Letlhakane and those communities that have been affected need to take up. But I do know that issue is contentious and has been, you know, a matter of ongoing discussions and conversations between the company and the people of Bakwe. But, you know, as a trade union, obviously, we believe that if any rights, you know, of a community have been violated, that community has to assert and defend those rights. Mm-hmm. But not only that, we need to make sure that when these processes are undertaken, they are done, you know, in a lawful way. You know, they're done in a way that also respects, you know, the dignity of that community, respects the rights, whether it be spiritual or cultural of that community. But I know that one has been a highly contentious issue that only the parties themselves, I think, would, with further engagements, you know, find a solution, if any, towards, you know, resolving whatever issues that currently exist between them.
The Mines and Minerals Amendment Act No. 14 of 2024 has officially been enacted in Botswana. This legislation is the centerpiece of the current government's post-2024 election agenda to reform the mining sector. Its primary objectives include promoting beneficiation, enhancing citizen participation, and strengthening sector governance. The global green energy transition offers Botswana a unique advantage due to the high demand for its critical minerals. While our mining sector can drive this shift, realizing this potential demands focused efforts to strengthen value chains, prioritize local beneficiation, and equip citizens with the skills needed for meaningful participation. I caught up with Khorata Ramokhotwane from the Secretariat of the Botswana Council of Churches to speak about the mining town community readiness towards change of the economy drivers in Botswana. You will often hear me refer to her as Osrat.
As we think and talk about diversification of the Botswana economy, what conversations are being had in community to prepare them for what is coming beyond the diamond mining industry economy, as it were?
I don't know. I think we are panicking, not just as people around the mining community, but the whole country as a whole. Because for the past 6-8 months, maybe more, we have not sold. So it means there's no income that is coming in from the diamonds. So that is also affecting our revenue. We are in panic mode. We are asking ourselves, what could we have done better? Not just as the government, not just as society, but as members of the community, to find ways of surviving post the diamonds era. And this happening now, it comes as a wake-up call to us. We have our agriculture industry. We are people of meat. We have our cattle, but many, more than people. We have more cattle than people. And now the markets decide what they want. If they look at us, the quality of our meat, and say, this time is not what we want, so it means we have to consume locally. They look at our diamonds and say, we really don't
now
have money.
Now there's artificial manufacturing
really
of diamonds.
Yes, now they are doing synthetic diamonds and all that. So the government is trying to engage us as members of the communities to have cooperatives where now we can embark in large-scale agricultural produce and also tap into green economies. So we are looking into having solar plants. We are looking into hydroponics for food security. We are looking into smart agriculture technologies. We are looking into rainwater harvesting for household use, so that each and every one of us at least have a meal at the end of the day. And then large scale, we are being encouraged to go into manufacturing. But we need capital to start all that which we are trying to do. So
how will the government come in to play a role to support initiatives for entrepreneurship?
Unfortunately, we all look into the government to give us seed funding so that we can start our initiatives.
Or investors. I mean, there's a Curry Global Expo taking place right now.
Yes.
And how that can also feed into that.
Exactly. So there's that conversation of how can we open up our economy and look beyond the diamond industries or the mining industry as a whole. Because some years back, we closed the Celebifica mine. It had employed a lot of people. It was catastrophic. Some people ended up committing suicide because they couldn't see life beyond. They couldn't imagine themselves at home, rearing cattle, plowing at the fields. They just could not imagine life outside the mine town. So that incident was a wake-up call again for us to say, we need to really start thinking outside the box. We need to really brand our country. We need to really market our country so that we don't just rely on the diamonds.
Kitso Phiri also emphasized this point. As the leap Botswana will make from a single commodity economy, a move away from a reliance on mining by creating new industries and skills, there is a risk posed by the fact that there is job insecurity now, and if not managed properly, could become a problem. Is there any drive or push towards diversification initiatives, advocating for retraining and skills development for workers to ensure they remain employable in a possible post-mining economy?
I think the answer to that is yes. The new transformation, the economic transformation plan, is looking at the issue of diversification. I know it's an issue that has been the subject of many discussions before, whether it be, you know, integrated in some of the policy documents that we've had. But I think for the first time in Botswana, we are now seeing a deliberate effort by government, including other interested stakeholders, such as Botswana Mine Workers Union, who are driving for diversification. And the reason being that, one, Botswana has been a single commodity economy for a very long time. In those days, revenue was coming left, right, and center to Botswana. We weren't really worried. And I think we also got to a point where government became too lethargic to explore other, you know, opportunities to diversify because we are just getting so much export revenue from minerals. But now with synthetics coming into play and also taking up quite a sizable chunk of the market share, natural diamond producing countries such as Botswana are finding themselves on the back foot because now we have to compete for market share space. But synthetics, because of the notion that they are mined sustainably and natural diamonds are not, it means that economies such as Botswana that are, you know, reliant and dependent on the single commodity are in trouble. And we are in trouble because if you look at the latest figures, you know, government and some of the developments in the country, government employees, number one, have not been paid consistently on a regular basis as it's the norm. Number two, healthcare. We've been experiencing a shortage of medication in government hospitals.
There was a state of emergency.
Right? It was a state of emergency, yes. You're looking now at revenue for infrastructure development. A lot of projects that were in the last national development plan were seized or stopped or halted, you know, to allow, you know, for the country's revenue to increase. And we are now seeing even BURS, the revenue service, I mean, they're now enhancing their efforts towards collection of tax. And that has become now a thing. So obviously, with those and with the issue around diversification, obviously, with all of these things, it means, you know, if the country continues on this trajectory, we are likely to find ourselves now in a serious, serious bind. So now with diversification, yes, government is now looking at investment opportunities such as in renewable energy, for instance, where we are now looking at renewable energy sources. We are trying to tap into our solar, abundance of solar, you know, or solar energy that we currently have in Botswana, which we could use, you know, as a revenue stream. We collect it, we mine it, we start selling it to the Southern African poor. But obviously, that transition requires transition also in terms of scale. It also requires planning, you know, from HRDC, the Human Resources Development Council, for instance, to forecast what skills will be needed in this transition should, you know, government actually undergo this transition. If we are to diversify into other streams, into other economic sectors, what are some of those skills that will be required as we transition people from predominantly a mining focused, you know, skill set to maybe ecotourism, to agriculture, you know,
or the creative economy,
or even the creative economy as well. You know, Botswana has been doing quite well. If you're looking at athletics, that also should be, could be an area that we could start looking at sport, looking at management and building capacity in those areas. So yes, diversification will be looking at that. And I think now government is really taking a deliberate or making a deliberate effort to ensure that we move away from over-reliance and dependence on diamond mining.
And seeing as you now have a second sovereign wealth fund as a country, would that also facilitate some of this, how it's funded?
Yes, no, definitely. Definitely. I think the sovereign fund was actually a welcome move by government. I think it's something that, you know, we for a very long time been requesting government, but I think our, you know, our government at the time was not ready, you know, for some of these developments. But I think the Sovereign Wealth Fund will definitely provide some much needed investment into areas that can really uplift and also resuscitate
the value chain.
Yes, yeah.
With all that is said around economic turnaround strategies for Botswana, which will still make its markets lucrative for other income revenues for ordinary citizens, what can be said of alternative industries? In an article by the Daily News in July 2025, according to Minister for State President Moeti Mohwasa, arts and culture represents a significant economic opportunity, serving as an exportable commodity capable of boosting foreign exchange earnings. Mohwasa emphasized the creative sector, encompassing fine arts, crafts, music, film, jewelry, publishing, and fashion design, is a powerful engine for job creation. This potential is supported by the 2019 BIDPA study, which found that creative industries already contribute 5.45% of Botswana's gross domestic product, GDP. Highlighting the sector's rapid growth and potential for innovation in revitalizing communities. Mohwasa concluded by appealing to the business community for increased support of local artists and the creative industry. Recognizing the vast untapped potential within its cultural and creative sectors, Botswana has assembled a broad-based national team. This group, comprising members from government ministries, NGOs, the private sector, academia, and cultural professionals, is tasked with compiling the quadrennial periodic report. The purpose of this report is to establish an up-to-date and comprehensive baseline of policies supporting creativity in the country. Denham Richards, the founder and CEO of Opulent Entertainment Group, gives his take on the influence and potential of the creative industry in Botswana and what it has to offer in terms of opportunities.
I would probably say that it's starting. I think that there's a lot of people that will see this interview and be very upset because I think depending on who you talk to, people feel like there is an industry. And the reality of it is when you're talking about an industry, that suggests that there is a center, a place that you can go where you can see things happening. So if I was to go to Hollywood and I was to say, hey, this is the entertainment industry, and you said, where is that? I could take you to a Warner Brothers. I could take you to Sony Studios. You can walk in, you can see stages and sets and all these other things. Here we see houses being rented, we see some small office buildings, small little production things, but that's what we would call more of a gig economy, right? That's not necessarily an industry. And so I think sometimes we have to be very careful about how we're defining industry, because if you say that it's an industry and you're talking to people that run industries and then you invite them into that space and you're like, where is it? And it's two or three people. That's why they don't take it seriously. So I think that what we're trying to do as OPEC, as well as a lot of other companies that are here, we're really trying to set a high standard so that when we're pitching entertainment industry, when people come, they can be like, yeah, this is something that we really need to put more energy behind.
And what does Denham think about how accessible these opportunities are for people who live outside of the capital's main towns and cities? And how can they benefit?
I think for us at OPEG and Dining with Diamonds, we have a thing called Diamonds in the Community, where we want to perform in the city centers, but then we also want to go outside and start to get the kids younger so that they get into the arts, but not just the in front of the camera stuff. We need people behind the camera. We need producers. We need camera people. We need sound people. So there's so many jobs that this industry can provide, but that doesn't happen if you're meeting them when they're already 25 and 30 years old. You got to get them when they're younger so that then they get educated. You educate the families as well. Then they see it as a viable business.
So So we understand what the community has to say about the legacy of mining in their lives and how the full or partial presence of development has taken a toll on the well-being of their lives. We've been enlightened to how government and business protections and interventions are looking closer at diversification and emerging markets that can shelter Botswana people from the shift from one dominant diamond industry. What oversight and monitoring capability exists to ensure best practice and good governance? And what is the experience been for Botswana? I speak to Robert Letsatsi of Botswana Watch Organization to expand on how a human-centered approach to human rights and business overlaps. Robert, Articles 21 and 24 concerning natural resources and the environment in the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, otherwise known as the Banjul Charter, that guide how African nations and extractive industries should operate. Additionally, resolutions and guidelines like the Niamey Declaration and reports on the African Commission's Working Group on Extractive Industries elaborate on these obligations, emphasizing corporate responsibility, community participation, environmental protection, and access to remedial violations in the sector. How is this effectively being regulated with mining companies in Botswana?
From which the absence of corporate social responsibility or investment policy in Botswana, I think it's an issue, because most of the corporate, they don't have anything guiding them taught how to give back to the community in which they operate. So normally it will be incumbent upon either the MD of that particular company or the management if they want to give back to the community. That's what. Two, Botswana, we don't have any that kind of framework, ESG. Mm-hmm. We don't have that type of framework which gets the ESG. And then lastly, we don't have the labor social plan. In terms of social protection, of course, there are some bits and pieces of those who are enshrined in our Mines and Minerals Act. But the problem becomes, it still becomes its monitoring and its enforcement. That's all.
Robert, you speak about how ESG, environmental social governance, is a framework that is missing from the Botswana framework around treatment of people, governance management practices, and the criteria to measure sustainability and attract funding, build trust. Is there a way that Botswana Watch is doing some work around enforcing some kind of strategies that can be guaranteed and implemented to make sure that this actually becomes a reality?
The only strategy that we normally employ is just to talk to the inhabitants in the proximity of an extraction, just try to unearth their lived realities where they are living next to a mine. The array of challenges that they still persist in terms of environmental, in terms of water pollution, in terms of air pollution, in terms of noise pollution. The only thing you can do as civil society is just to document these community voices. After documenting them, we can present them to the policymakers and advocate for any amendments in terms of legislation or a cause for a piece of legislation to be enacted. That's how far we can go.
How would Botswana Watch track whether mineral revenues are being appropriately allocated to non-extractive sectors and public service, which are intended for national development plans? We have just been to Letlhakane. While they speak of some development that has taken place over the years, they lament over how they feel neglected over availability of opportunities and allocation to profits, which benefit the communities.
Mineral trading, I think, is one of the areas that needs attention. In Botswana, normally the revenues generated from the mines that are normally distributed through the national development plans. So which means even if you are from Letlhakane, yesterday and about almost four diamond mines in Letlhakane, you must have realized. Mm-hmm. And one thing which is mostly glaring in Letlhakane is the level of poverty. But normally what the government is saying that they cannot give people from Letlhakane more share of the revenue generated from the mines, because that will cause, what's the way that they use, sort of like war. Yeah, so they say, no, we just distribute them. The gap that we've identified in that area is that the absence of a Royalties Act. I think that could be a problem.
Robert, what would you say has been one of the successes that Botswana Watch has had oversight on in terms of reporting on accountability and transparency in the extractive industry in Botswana?
Before we go to the extractive sector, because the other area I work on is corruption, where we managed to negotiate with our corruption busting agency. It's called Directorate on Corruption and Economic Crime, DCEC. Mm-hmm. Yes, managed to have an MOU with them through our umbrella body, which is Bokongo. That MOU will serve as parameters of engagement where we can able to work on issues of corruption. On the extractive sector, our highlights will be we have a flagship program that we do on an annual basis. We call it the Alternative Mining Forum, where we are trying to bring these three key stakeholders under one roof for a constructive dialogue. And then one of the outcome of that event is just to have recommendations and communiques, which emanates from the people. Mm. And then we presented it to the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee responsible for minerals. So, and then we say, let's have any reform. So that's one of our success. But otherwise, we document those issues and we just present them. But there's been a shift of change, especially from the mining company side in terms of engagement with the community. First and foremost, the mining company don't have engagement plan with the community. But some of them, they said since our engagement, they managed to develop that engagement plan. So they have made a deliberate plan how they engage the community on a 3 months basis. That's why. Two, the grievance mechanism. Out of the two mining companies we had to approach, the one they have developed the grievance mechanism and they have loaded them on their website. Lastly, they say they are going to support the community in terms of consulting them first to do needs assessment, so that they don't think that the community, they need a certain service where the community they don't. I'll give you a classical example. One of the communities that we consulted, it's almost 86 northeast of Hanzi, is called Grootlacht. Mm-hmm. It's going to be almost at the border of Namibia. The mining companies bought them bees, and then they dumped those bees in the school so that the school can rear the bees and then also sell honey from that. Later on, those bees, they terrorized the students, and they were called to go and get them. And they did. Mm-hmm. So, but nowadays, now they started to consult them. What do you need in your local community? And then they are also trying to align donations with what the district they are planning, like in terms of we have district development plans. So they are trying to align their donations with that.
As Botswana moves away from diamond reliance, is this human capital investment gap a key area being actively presented to potential investors? Were these specific workforce development needs a prominent part of the Global Expo conversations that took place in Botswana? What can one describe as the roadmap ahead? I asked Tsholofelo Mpapi of Business Botswana what he thinks.
Oh, no, most definitely. There is a lot that is happening. And the business community is also part of these conversations of reskilling and retooling our people so that they don't become casualties of the development trajectory. So it's definitely things that are not only being conversed about, but also being incorporated in most of the business models that the business community in Botswana are doing. So this concept of reskilling, retooling, is definitely a part of the package of strategies that as a country we are adopting. And as Business Botswana, as a private sector association, we are encouraging and we are advocating quite strongly for those. But we also need to be cognizant of the fact that we are communicating with government that they need to understand from an industry perspective what exactly we need to be changing in the skills set of our people now. So it needs not be driven from the government, but it needs to be industry driven, because it's the industry that understands the trajectory or the needs that needs to be at the forefront of this reskilling and retooling. And it's challenging the conventional way of training, of professional development, rather than this kind of a classroom format. We are seeing our members, our business Botswana members, the private sector, doing in-factory training where people are retooled within the setup of a product or a service that they'll be offering, rather than this kind of a conventional way. We are also seeing discussions around a partnership between the private sector and government on TVET, technical vocational education training, rather than using the conventional way of doing it. And these are things that are currently happening to ensure the continuity. Yes, this is something that is already not only in conversation, it's in the conversation, obviously, on a continuous basis at a policy level, but in terms of implementation, the practicals, the operational part, the private sector is already advanced in terms of incorporating them into their day-to-day business model.
Botswana is poised for a promising future, having firmly established herself as a nation dedicated to prioritizing its people and asserting its global position. Despite ongoing challenges, particularly concerning indigenous and land rights, and the refinement of CSI-CSR policies, a palpable sense of optimism pervades. Compliance is another key component of this. The launch of initiatives like the Botswana Economic Transformation Program signals a determined commitment to economic diversification and a shift in national mindset. Crucially, this vision includes advancing public sector reforms to ensure governance keeps pace with a modern, competitive economy. With continued insightful planning and a human-centered approach, Botswana is set to successfully transition beyond dependence on single commodity revenues, becoming a pioneering example of comprehensive national expansion and transformation. My right, your right, our right. Humanity is and continues to be for us all. This has been the third and final episode of Season 6 of Let's Talk Human Rights, the FNF Africa podcast exploring various human rights issues. I have certainly enjoyed your company on the airwaves, as always, and your listenership through the season and the years past. The Friedrich Naumann Foundation Sub-Saharan Africa, FNF, is an independent German organization that is committed to promoting liberal ideals and politics in Africa, such as human rights, the rule of law, democracy, innovation, digitization, and free trade. By conducting campaigns, media events, seminars, workshops, study tours, cultural happenings, and training courses, the foundation promotes human rights, including freedom of expression, freedom of the press, children's rights, and LGBTQIA+ rights, and engages against violence targeting women and capital punishment. If you're interested in our activities, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and X. Simply check for Friedrich Naumann Foundation Africa. The links are in the show notes.